Welcome back to my series on morality. My name is Father Cody, and we are in part 6 of this series. If you're looking for the moral principles, the first 4 sections are about moral principles, and these last 4 are on the application of these principles to real-world issues. Today's topic being political ethics. So let's begin. So we talk about political ethics, we normally talk about politics, which are not necessarily the same thing. So politics is the interworking of government and officials and all those different people and ideas that form the governance of a country. Political ethics are how do we as people, we as a country, we as a nation within countries, deal with each other. That's pretty much what it comes down to. Now, as we head into the issue of political ethics, most of us hear this topic and think of various things, such as how one ought to behave, or, more importantly, a disgust towards politics. Pope Francis calls this out in his last encyclical Fratelli Tutti on brotherly love, in that so much of our modern world is dominated by a disgust or a dislike of politics. He mentions something that we need to hold in mind as we head into this topic on political ethics. Politics has a good. Actually, politics is meant for the good. We as people gather together to form a governance. The governance is designed, it's oriented towards the good for all people. A proper functioning government should strive to make sure the good is meant for all people. And that's where we have to focus. We don't want to focus on the negativity that so many of us feel. Instead, focus on what it ought to be. What is the ideal? What does politics strive for? And just for fun, I'm going to quote a little bit of his encyclical so you get a sense of his desire and also his insights into politics. Although misuse of power, corruption, disregard for law, and inefficiency must clearly be rejected, economics without politics cannot be justified, since this would make it impossible to favor other ways of handling the various aspects of the present crisis. Instead, what is needed is a politics which is far-sighted and capable of new, integral, and interdisciplinary approach to handling the various aspects of this crisis. In other words, a healthy politics capable of reforming and coordinating institutions, promoting best practices, and overcoming undue pressure and bureaucratic inertia. We cannot expect economics to do this, nor can we allow economics to take over the real power of the state. He makes a point. Politics has an ideal. It's meant to form a governance, gather people together, work towards the good, and have this long-range sight as to what we ought to be. With that in mind, and with this more idealistic form of politics on our minds, let us head into the first topic on political ethics, immigration. As I head into all these different topics within each ethical category, I want to make a point that I want to balance out all the perspectives. What are the various viewpoints that go with these topics, and how do they coalesce into something useful for us? For instance, in immigration, there's clearly 2 sides to this debate. There are people who favor open borders and allow free immigration between our nation and other nations, and there's those who want very sharp closed borders, saying, no, we don't want to allow any people in. Regardless of where you may stand on this, here are some things to keep in mind. So when we talk about immigration, we have to understand people. We also have to understand politics. The first basic principle underlying immigration is that countries have a right to secure their borders. This is an important right. It's something we don't always think about. Countries are important. By having a boundary, by knowing my nationality, by knowing what people I'm associated with, I can work towards a common good. The people I'm associated with form a common culture. They are my people. I know where I'm from. I know who my parents are. I know what events happen in my life that connect me with my culture. I know what things we hold dear. I have a history. I have a land. All these things are essential goods for people. To know our history and culture is part of who we are. To feel safe and secure and to know where homeland is a right for all people. And so in this way, securing our borders is not just holding firm boundaries, it's a recognition of peoples. By having firm boundaries, by knowing where our lands end, by knowing what we're not, and by knowing who we are, we can form a union. We can form a group of people. We can have a common governance. We can work towards a common good. This is all part of what it means to secure our borders or to have a right to our border. Far extremist views of this would say that if we had open borders, it would not be an issue. Well, it would. We had this happen several times in the last year, actually, where because of political issues or war, the Syrian crisis being the one on my mind, and now the Hungarian crisis, followed by the Ukrainian crisis, in all these situations where large numbers of refugees infiltrated a country, we had the issue where that country was starting to lose its identity. There was too many immigrants with their own culture, and therefore they are overwhelming the common culture of the people who lived in that country. This is one of the challenges that comes with full open borders. If I can't secure who I am and who my people are, I no longer exist. The country ceases to exist as far as a people goes. As far as borders, that's a different situation. And so in this way, all countries have a right to secure their borders. All countries have a right to know who their citizens are, who they're protecting, who they're providing for, who they are as people. They have a right to keep their common culture and heritage, and to have a sense of well-being and a sense of safety within their borders. So that's one perspective, or one side of this debate. The other side of this is the right of peoples. Peoples have a right to immigrate. Now, they do this for many reasons, and this is where we have to exercise some caution. Because people don't immigrate from one country to another just on a whim, except in more affluent modern society. People who immigrate are usually people who are refugees, in political crisis, economic destitution, or have some serious reason to immigrate. Just think of it this way. Put yourself in a more impoverished country. If you are a person in a more impoverished country where you don't have opportunities for economic advancement, you have to fund the entire trip from your country to the next country, in which you may never see your family again, you are leaving your cultural and identical and heritage to leave to another place with different culture and heritage, you are leaving behind almost everything. This is the mentality we need to understand as we deal with immigration. Immigration is a serious issue for those who choose to do so. Leaving behind culture, family, economic development, and everything just to be able to have some hope for a future is a pretty serious choice. We have to respect that. So in that way, if we understand the peoples of the world as our brothers and sisters, if we understand them as human beings who are seeking something better, it changes our entire perspective on the rights of people. Now, people who are immigrating should be seen as human beings. People who immigrate should be seen as needing something serious. They need either economic development or they're seeking refugee status. All these things are big issues. As I talk about this, I want to bring up a few stories that I know, because they may help you understand the challenges that America faces regarding immigration. When I was in seminary, one of my professors told us the story of his wife, who's Japanese. As she was choosing to become a citizen of the United States, he would go with her to the immigration hearings. During those hearings, the officer would yell at her in English, saying, "Why don't you speak English? Why don't you understand me?" He thought to himself as he was dealing with this, what would happen if both people did not speak English? They would just be yelled at the entire time and not have a clue what was going on. I also know of many situations in which people who chose to immigrate legally and wanted legal status as citizens did their best to try to do it legally, but because of the challenges that go with politics and economics, had to pay thousands of dollars to bribe officials just to get paperwork passed that they didn't know had to be submitted. Our system is immensely corrupt, and that's what the largest challenge for those who want to do so legally. So when we talk about the rights of people, I want to keep those stories in mind, because those stories remind us of how badly we treat people, how if we were to respect people's dignity and find ways, economically, politically, to make the system easier, it would be more likely that people would choose the legal status, and therefore we could monitor our borders better. So this is the conflict. I've already brought it up a couple times to emphasize my point. The conflict is between these two rights people have. The rights and dignity of people, and the rights of countries to secure their borders. The rights of those who live there to keep their cultural heritage and to feel like they can economically provide for themselves, and the people who are coming to escape destitute situations so as to rise and advance and to flourish as human beings. What this looks like is a different question altogether. I'm not sure what the answer for immigration is, but I think if we see the principles and we change our viewpoints on immigration, we may be able to dialogue and converse about the proper ways to change our system and to allow people to immigrate freely, but also with constraints, to be treated respectfully and to find ways to flourish, but also to recognize who we are and how we advance as a people. The next one's kind of a boring topic in my mind. It's important for us as American citizens, but not necessarily the case for peoples throughout the world, and that is voting. In America, we have the great privilege that we can participate in our governance system. If we were in other places like China, North Korea, or Russia, that would not be the case. We are definitely compliant with whoever is in charge, and we will feel it if we choose otherwise. But in America, we have a totally different system, and one that we don't always take advantage of, nor do we understand well. The system of voting that we have is our way of participating with the governance of the country. It's our way of establishing what is good and right, and promoting what is good and right through our votes. It also comes with it a few challenges that I'll mention here in a moment as we work through the system and recognize how it works. So here's the thing. When we start out with, voting is a moral obligation for American citizens. That sound is strange to some people's ears, I assume, and it may seem harsh to others. Voting is a moral obligation, and here's why. Voting is our way of participating in governance. Participating in governance means we can strive for the good. Inasmuch as we can strive for the good, we are obliged to do so. Therefore, if voting is our means of fighting for the good and establishing good in our country, we are morally obliged to do so. That being said, there's a second side to it. We don't just cast votes for the sake of casting votes. A truly moral person who strives for the good of this country and wants to see it flourish also recognizes there's a secondary obligation. Not just to vote, but to be aware of the policies, procedures, and the issues that are on the table. We must be informed about what's going on and have a good sense of what's happening in our country. Without knowing what is going on, without a sense of the issues and what's underlying them, we can't assume we're fighting for the good or voting for the good. Instead, we're just voting for the sake of voting. So these two obligations do have to come together. We have to not only vote, and that it is a moral obligation, but we also must be informed about our voting and our decisions, so that when we do vote, we are voting with a good conscience, and we are voting for what is truly good. Now, the issue that usually plagues voting is not so much the fact of voting or the obligation of voting. It's the weird situation we find ourselves in this particular country. Namely, we are a two-party system. I know there are other parties out there, but largely, and I will quote someone here in a moment, those who are in one of two parties, the Republicans or the Democrats, are the ones who get the votes and become the people in power. Some people argue that if you don't cast your vote for a Democrat or Republican, you're basically throwing away your vote. That's not necessarily true, and I'll get to that in a moment. Because we are in a two-party system, it causes quite a few challenges for people who see the broader perspective on things. If we notice that the parties are kind of polar opposites, then we also recognize that voting for one is essentially voting against the other. And some policies that the Democrats have may be good, and some that the Republicans have may be good, and yet there seems to be no middle ground. So in this way, it becomes very challenging for us to vote for specific issues or particular platforms because everything's lumped into one party. That being said, we can never vote for something that is immoral. Why would you support something that's immoral? I don't know how to speak more eloquently about that topic, but nevertheless, we can never vote for something that is immoral. So if a politician stands on that topic, or a party does, we have to vote against it, or not vote for that particular platform or party. Here is the issue that people bring up in relation to that. What happens if both parties, the major parties that people say are worth voting for, have immoral stances? They both have stances that are immoral. What do you do? So in this weird situation, where there is clearly a sharp divide, and the divide between the two makes both situations immoral, there are several options. Since we aren't technically a two-party system, the third option is to vote for one of the other parties. Some claim it's throwing away your vote, but that's not true, because we must always vote with our conscience. We must always vote in such a manner that we keep our consciences clean and we vote for what is right and good. So that being said, a third party might be that vote. But it's us that matters. The second side of it, and the fourth option in that way, is to just not vote. If it is truly a situation where both possible votes will lead to an immoral situation or increase immorality in our country, then we do not have the obligation to vote any longer, because we never have the obligation to vote for something that is immoral. Okay, that's enough on voting. Our third topic for today is governance. This could be about how to govern a country, but that's not really what I want to focus on. There is one very important principle that's underlying this idea of governance that I want to emphasize, but there's also several subcategories under the idea of governance that are important to emphasize as well. When we talk about governance, it's how does the country govern itself? This has been hotly debated for many centuries. What is the proper way to govern people? What is considered right and good? And how ought we to be governed? Some claim that monarchy is the best, such as Aristotle. Some claim that a democratic republic or democracy is the best, because it allows people to freely express their viewpoints. Some claim that the only way to really govern a people well is through communism, fascism, or some sort of totalitarian regime. I think we've seen the last few centuries that doesn't go quite as well as we hoped. There are lots of glaring problems there. But that being said, there's glaring problems with all governmental systems. None of them seem to be perfect. They all have some issue. But that being said, regardless of what system we use, there are certain things or principles that are important to emphasize. The first principle is the principle of subsidiarity. The principle of subsidiarity states that what can happen at the lowest governance should happen at the lowest governance. What could happen at the lowest governance should happen at the lowest governance. That sounded strange. Let me give you an example. My primary example for this one is food banks. Food banks are designed to provide food for those who are low income or in need of food. Right now, largely, food banks are controlled by the federal government, which means the highest possible level, the federal government, they are dictating across the entire country how food banks ought to operate, how they structure who comes, what kind of foods they have, and how they give food out. That being said, not every state in this union is the same. What may be necessary in California may not make sense in Montana, and what people may crave in Louisiana may not be the same as Maine. We're making everyone across the country equal in the distribution of food. The principle of subsidiarity states that what could happen at the lowest possible level of governance should happen at the lowest possible level of governance. Here where I am at, all three communities of White Sulphur Springs, fund these food banks. And because of that, the government has no say in it. What this does is it makes the people respond to the needs of the people. They know the people, they know who comes in, they can build relationships, they can help them in their struggles, they can help them figure out what's best, and we can monitor who comes and who doesn't, and work together in this network of food banks. So in this way, that level of governance, the local community level, it is possible to fully function a food bank at that low level of governance, and therefore it should. Because look what it does. This is what the principle of subsidiarity is all about. It responds to people's needs. It lets the community be involved. It gives them a form of charity, a form of expression, a way to contribute to the good of the people around them. And it helps everyone lift everyone up as far as providing for this, guiding people to seek food, helping people to recognize their economic challenges, and meets the needs of individual peoples. That's the goal of subsidiarity. The goal of subsidiarity is to meet the person and not just the people, so that each person is taken care of, not just this general populace. Another great example of subsidiarity is highways. Highways versus interstates, technically. So interstates, since they cross state lines, are governed by the federal government. And therefore, the federal government sets rules regarding the maintenance of these interstates and what's required to get that funding across all 50 states. But yet, snow removal practices in Montana are not the same as what's necessary in Arizona. How interstates are used in California are not the same as Nebraska. And so although we set these standards across the states, they don't really apply well to the individual concerns of these states. That being said, when it starts to cross state lines, who controls what? That's always the big question, which is why the federal government controls it. State highways, however, are run and operated and funded by the state themselves. So like the state of Montana does not use de-icers on highways, but because the federal government requires it for interstates, it's used on interstates. The same way, the way we maintain highways is different than interstates because they have different sources of funding. This allows the state to figure out where best to allocate funds, where highways are used most, and how to provide the most for peoples. This is the principle of subsidiarity. Underneath the topic of governance is also the topic of taxes. Taxes is not a topic we like, because it means giving money away. That being said, I need everyone to see the good that happens through taxes and taxation. A lot of times we just get disappointed because of how much we have to pay, which I don't blame you. Whenever we pay taxes, it means that we lose money, kind of. And this is the side we have to see. Taxes means the funding of programs like police departments, fire departments, hospitals, goods in our community, as well as goods across the nation. That's the point of taxes, so that we are morally obliged as Christians to pay taxes because we are citizens who benefit from the effects of taxes. Otherwise, it'd be considered stealing. There is one exception to the rule of taxation. In the event that our taxes are going to something that we know is immoral and can follow the money trail to know those specific dollars are going to that specific immoral action, we would no longer be obliged to pay taxes. That would be immensely hard. I don't know how you'd be able to track it so effectively given such a massive system we are in to find that that particular dollar went to that particular event. Other than that, we are morally obliged. This next one is very important to me. Obedience to government officials. This is something that I personally have been sad about over the last decade, where our political squabbles and disappointments with governance have led to attacking individual people and, to a large extent, the offices of our governance. When I was in high school, one of the teachers who I came close to, we were chatting one day after class, and she mentioned, since this was during the Bush regime, that she did not like President Bush. I didn't think much of it, but then she said to me, "Even though I don't like him, I still respect him as our president." And this is what it means to be obedient to government officials. It doesn't mean we have to like every policy, doesn't mean we have to like them as a person, doesn't mean we have to like the way they govern, but we need to respect the office. And by respecting the office, respecting our system of voting, and respecting how we came to this point, we now have a different way of interacting with government. If we have respect for our president, then we work towards the good, striving to work within the system and through the system to promote that good. The same thing works with the Senate and the House. If we understood them as voted officials, who even if I didn't vote for, are voted in legally, then I will work with them and through them to work towards the good for this country. That is the beauty of obedience to government officials. It means that the system matters, that these people in governance matter, that I can still work within it for the good and strive for the good, even if it didn't go the way I wanted. This next topic is one that's heavily debated. It's just war theory. Is there such a thing as a just war? I want you to ponder that for a moment. Can we justify the acts of war? What would it look like to have a war that is truly just? We have done all the things right and we have lived morally the acts of war. So there's various things we have to keep in mind as we wrestle with this question of whether there can be a just war. The first one and the most important one out of all this is the tragedy of war. We have to recognize how damaging and devastating the effects of war are. War kills people. There's no way around that. People die when there is war. Not only that, citizens die, not just soldiers. People lose land. Land is destroyed. In some cases, huge swaths of land is just obliterated, leaving people economically destitute or without a home or even sometimes without a nation because of the devastation of war. We must always remember what war costs and what it costs the people who survive, the people who die, the people who lost loved ones, the people whose land was affected. War is tragic. Within the tragedy of war comes a very common topic, which is collateral damage. Collateral damage is our way of describing effects of war that were deemed necessary, but were still under the tragedy of war. This would include the destruction of hospitals, destruction of housing, destruction of citizens who were not soldiers. This is how we call collateral damage. Now, to give you a sense of the tragedy of collateral damage, I want to give you a quick overview of war over the last 300 years. If we go back to the 18th century, the beginning of the 1700s, war was fought on battlefields outside of cities between two legions of trained soldiers. Soldiers fought soldiers. Soldiers did not fight citizens. Citizens did not fight soldiers unless they were taking over their town. Soldiers were trained and set up for battle, and the ways of war were simple. Maybe catapults, swords, archers, and that's pretty much it. As we move into the 19th century, now we're in the 1850s, 1860s, with Napoleonic Wars, Napoleon was the first one to institute total war. And total war means that the costs of war were not as important as the success of war. Napoleon once quoted to a friend who was lamenting that he lost 30,000 soldiers that last year due to war. Napoleon said, 30,000? You lost 30,000? I lost 30,000 in a day. The transition between medieval war and modern war is sharp. It goes from a well-trained battalion of soldiers who fought, and the casualties of which are dire to the good of the nation, to sending hordes and hordes of soldiers who would needlessly die in battle, and just whoever has the most wins kind of mentality, like risk. That change in the way we deal with combat and the way we see war also affected the way we understand collateral damage. Now, collateral damage through ballistics or war machines destroys towns, cities, buildings, swaths of people, all kinds of things are part of this destructive nature of war. A good example, since we're in the midst of it, during the war between Russia and Ukraine, there was a weapon that could have been used called a thermonuclear device. The thermonuclear device sends off a mist of basically gas that slowly permeates the area, and then after a little bit of time, the bomb sends the second detonation that ignites it all, and the whole thing erupts in flames. This device is used to kill soldiers that are behind walls or within buildings or behind fortified structures because the gas seeps into everything. However, the bomb does not discriminate against who it attacks. It can be anyone, including citizens, animals, soldiers, people on the street. Anyone can be affected by something like that. This is an example of total war. Another good example that's at least on American minds is the Hiroshima and Nagasaki nuclear explosions. We launched nuclear bombs upon an entire city, killing anyone who is in that city, mostly not soldiers. This is the casualties of war. The next topic under total war would be the cause of war, or the casus belli. What causes justify war? Here are some common causes that people use, and then we'll talk about them and their justification. For example, the promotion of justice, the spread of democracy, the liberation of peoples, defense of one's own country, and religious liberty. Regardless of how we see these, the way we justify or understand the cause of war largely affects the way we fight the war and understand our connection with it. A good example, the promotion of justice. Well, that was used during World War II as the main cause of fighting against Nazi Germany. They were annihilating peoples. They were in a situation of taking over the world. So our defense was to the poor, innocent people being killed in the concentration camps. Hence the promotion of justice. Whether that was justified or not, that's up to you. You can go two ways with that one. The spread of democracy. The spread of democracy was used during the Afghan and Iraqi wars to show the peoples were oppressed, and by giving them democracy, they would be liberated and be able to live as free citizens and live more full lives if we give them democracy. Hence our justification for that war. Now, I know you're probably thinking there were other causes for that war, and you would be right. Rarely is there simply one cause. Largely, we use these things to make ourselves look good and to justify our war more than anything else. And if you're familiar with the spiritual masters, justifying oneself always leads to problems. So even though we may like the cause, even though we may think we're on the right track, that does not mean that the war is just. The next one, liberation of peoples, I've talked about already. Defense of one's country, or self-defense. According to moral law, we are always justified in defending ourselves. Does that work for a country? What are the boundaries around self-defense? Clearly, if the soldiers are on our territory, on our soil, that is clearly self-defense. But what if a country has fought three other countries, and we border those countries, and now they might be after us? Can we go to war even though those soldiers are not physically on our land? Or what if a country sends a missile towards us, doesn't attack us, but it's almost like a threat? Is that threat enough to justify war? These are the challenges of self-defense. At what point do we draw a line saying, this is the line that when crossed, it is self-defense versus engaging in war for another reason? The last one, religious liberty, has not been used for quite a while. It was used, especially during the Middle Ages, to defend a faith or to defend someone's faith or to promote faith in various ways, and largely, especially in the last couple hundred years, has been denounced as not a decent cause for war. Out of this list, I think you would agree with me that the only one that truly works as a cause for war, a truly justified cause for war, is self-defense. If we're defending ourselves, that does justify our war. All the other ones, there's bound to be some other way to work within a system that we don't have the tragedy of war and the consequences of war, but can still get the effects we need of liberty or justice. Again, there are exceptions, but nevertheless, we must ponder this one deeply. So I ask you, as we finish this topic, does a just war exist? Can we justify the effects of war and the action of going to war? Does liberation of oppressed people justify it? Is self-defense the only way, or is there no such thing as a just war? I leave you to ponder this very complicated topic that theologians have wrestled with for many centuries. The last topic is international obligations. As our world becomes increasingly more globalized, we have to recognize that we are part of this large system. As part of this large system, the effects of one country affect other countries. The choices of one country affect the abilities of other countries. We cannot see ourselves as isolated or independent any longer. We are now globalized, and nothing has shown the globalization of the world more so than mass media. Through Facebook, Twitter, even news sources themselves, we have information about countries across the globe that we haven't had ever before in human history. We have more information at our fingertips of the global situation we're in than ever before, and instantaneous in many ways, so that we know what's going on. So this is the first point, globalization. We cannot ignore our part in international politics, in the international sphere of things, as well as the global sphere of things. We are intermeshed into a system of all humanity, and we must see it as such. We cannot separate ourselves any longer. We must figure out how to participate. The first one is economics. Economics is a lot more challenging and a lot more important than it's ever been. We are no longer in a system where America has her economy and her industry and all those things and we're fine. No, we are now intermeshed in this global economic system through which countries trade with each other, they take out loans against each other, they buy loans from each other. We are so enmeshed that the economic decision of one country can radically affect the entire world. We saw this during COVID, that by one country choosing to lock down, it affected trade, it affected commerce, it affected even the cost of money across the entire globe. Same thing works as we deal with the trade agreements and manufacturing. So much of what's bought in America is manufactured outside of America, including China, Central America, and India, so that we pay these countries cheap labor so we can get things very cheaply. That's what we do. And so in that way, we as people are exploiting people across the globe for the sake of our good. We let people be in economically destitute situations so we can buy things that we want more cheaply. Here are a few examples of what I mean. Years ago, this was now middle of the 2010s, there was an international scandal that happened with China, where as a film crew was filming an iPhone company, a man jumped out a window and killed himself. Turns out that was a common occurrence. The conditions at that facility were so poor, people would routinely jump out the windows as a way to escape the situation they're in. China, in their brilliance, decided the best way to deal with this was to build these cushioned ramps around the building so when someone jumped out, they just slide back in and go about their business. In Central American countries, they largely buy a lot of the stuff we don't want. For instance, if a fashion trend fails, we will sell them all the extra clothing that didn't sell, and we'll make a small profit or at least break even, and they get all of our cheap gear that they can buy at whatever price they want. For instance, the Super Bowl. Every year there's one winner to the Super Bowl, and yet to make sure they can sell as much gear as possible, they print the gear for both teams in case one wins, they have all the gear ready to go. What about the other one? Where does it go? It gets sold to developing world countries at cheap prices so that they can make a little bit of a profit from it. This is the economics of our world. We have to see our actions as intricately connected with everything else, or we'll miss so much of what's going on and lead to the continued exploitation of peoples. Although this is a hot-button issue, I bring it up because it is rather important, and that's environmentalism. A good example of how environmentalism is now a global problem affecting all countries would be the earthquake at Fukushima in Japan. When the earthquake hit and the tsunami hit Fukushima, there was a huge issue. The issue was not the reactor, believe it or not. The issue was what the reactor might do. This nuclear reactor had the possibility of contaminating the ocean, affecting the entire Pacific Ocean, and becoming volatile to the point where it gets into the atmosphere and then starts to rain radioactive particles across America and even possibly Europe. So that natural disaster and the effects at Fukushima could have made a global health crisis. One power plant. That being said, there's more to environmentalism than simply that. I know you've heard of the big island of trash in the middle of the Pacific, but that's not the biggest issue. Our biggest issue coming up is water and water rights. Will we have enough clean water and available water to sustain human populations? What are we doing to our waters? What do we dump into them? Where does it go? How is it processed? Most waste treatment plants do not process chemicals in our water, only solid waste. So that being said, any chemicals we pour down the drain go to our rivers, streams, lakes, or oceans. There they sit until they decompose or, maybe not. we have to now understand our actions as affecting the entire globe. And it's hard for us to grasp that it is so very large. But this is part of environmentalism. How are we affecting the entirety of the globe? How are we promoting unhealthy practices or the degradation of human flourishing? I covered enough war that I don't really want to cover it much more. Instead of covering war, I want to cover interconnected countries, the best example being NATO. As modern society develops, there is a great desire of linking countries together in international pacts. It started long, long ago with the European Union, and then it continued into UN, and now NATO. This idea of all these countries conglomerating into one large protective organization shows the international ramifications of the world. If all the European countries are united and war breaks out against one of them, they're all at war now. This is the whole idea of world war and total war. When one country fights another, everyone's at war. A very challenging and difficult situation that we may find ourselves anytime soon, sadly enough, depending on how we deal with ourselves and the people around us. The next one is freedom of peoples. This one's challenging because we don't like to think about it that way. We like our American freedom. We like the fact that we feel free. But what about everyone else? Do we think of all people as brothers and sisters? Do we think of everyone as human and warranting the same rights, namely freedom, liberty, and the pursuit of good? Or do we think of only ourselves and we can do whatever we want with the peoples of the world? That led to slavery, that led to exploitation of the Mesoamerican region, that led to lots of different problems. So we have to ponder this one. What does it mean to strive for the good for all people? What does it mean to seek for freedom for all people? How do we understand ourselves as interconnected with the human race? Not just Americans, but the whole human race. The last one only affects America, and this is policing the world. As a global power, and as a nation within the context of the world, are we morally obliged to police the world? If not, who does? What happens if one country is oppressing its citizens? What happens if there's a genocide? What happens if one country goes to war against another? What do we do? Should we have an organization, a global power, that oversees this? I would honestly be very leery of that, because if we had a giant global power that oversaw everyone, given how corrupt most government organizations are, I would see that as causing severe problems. And this is one of the joys of international politics and individual countries. As individual countries, they have their own identity, and they're all kind of on equal playing field with everyone else. By having all these separate countries, no one can really move, especially now, without causing international problems. No one can really be fully powerful without causing ramifications from it. So by not having to police the world, or not seeing ourselves as policing the world, and more importantly, not striving for a one global power, we allow ourselves to be free as a country and allow all the other countries to just be. There isn't a reason to police. Technically, if we work to get along, we should do just fine. And that's the challenge. So as I finish this topic on political ethics, I want you to ponder many of these things. What does it mean that we are in a globalized society? What does it mean that our actions affect the entire globe? International politics, commerce, trade, war, the understanding of peoples. All these things are interconnected in how we understand who we are, what we ought to do, and how we're connected with everyone else.